When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 4 of The Thing from the Lake. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Thing from the Lake by Eleanor M. Ingram. Chapter 4. Fair speech is more rare than the emerald found by slave maidens on the pebbles. Ptah-Hotep. At 10 o'clock next morning, I was summoned from my sleep by the bell of the telephone beside my bed. It was not a pleasant sleep, although I had not returned to my apartment until dawn. Nightmare doubts galloped ruthless hooves over any repose. Phillida's voice came over the wire to me like the morning song of a bird. "Good morning, Cousin Roger. We are going to take the train in a few moments. But I could not leave New York without telling you how happy I am. Did I wake you up? I was afraid that I might, but Ethan said you would like me to call even so." "My dear, it was the kindest thought you ever had," I told her fervently. "Was it?" She hesitated. "Then, were they pretty dreadful to you at home?"
"Quite."
"Do you suppose they will do anything dreadful about us?"
"No, nothing."
It did not seem necessary to tell her that Aunt Caroline did not know where the runaways had gone, and was thereby debarred from hasty action. Phillida's father had privately agreed with me in this. "I am so very happy, Cousin Roger."
"I am glad, Phil."
"And you will come to the farm soon?"
"Soon," I promised.
So the nightmares of immediate anxiety for her galloped themselves away, routed for that time. Like my goldfish, when their bowl has been unduly shaken, I sank down again into the quieted waters of my little world and absorption in my own affairs. There have been hours when I wondered if I was of more importance than they, as a matter of cosmic fact. A month passed before I kept my promise to go to the farm in Connecticut. As a first reason, I wanted to leave my young couple alone for a period of adjustment. Also, I was curious to see how they would handle the business left to them. I held telephone conversations with Phillida and with various contractors now and then. I sent out the furnishings for my own room. Everything else I purposely left to the experimenters. There was a second reason, more obscure. I wanted to keep for a while the little mystery of the lady who had come to the farmhouse room in the dark of the night. She was pure romance, a rare incident in a prosaic age. My table had been bare of such delicately spiced morsels, and I relished the savor of this one upon my palate. I was not quite ready to find her in the matter-of-fact daughter of some neighbor who had sought shelter from the storm in that supposedly empty house, and probably mistaken me for a tramp. Perhaps I was equally reluctant to go back and prove that the adventure was ended, that she had been a bird of passage who had gone on with no thought of return. With all these delays, and the fact that my work really kept me busy in town, April was verging toward May when I finally saw the last of my luggage put into the car and started on my 50-mile drive to the house by the lake. I did not take this first visit very seriously, or intend it to be over long. To be a constraint upon the household I had established, or assume a right there, was far from the course I planned. It was not certain Vere and I would be comfortable housemates. But to stay away together would have hurt Phillida as much as to stay too long, I considered. Probably a week would be about enough for this time. so lightly, so ignorantly, I stepped from the first great division of my life into the second, not hearing the closing of the gate through which there was no turning back. End of chapter 4. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 5 of The Thing from the Lake. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Thing from the Lake by Eleanor M. Ingram. Chapter 5. The very room, 'cause she was in, seemed warm from floor to ceilin'. The Courtin'. I arrived at noon, when a bright sun set the country air afloat with notes like dust of gold. The place seemed drenched in golden light. Even the young grass had gold in its green, and the lake glittered hot with yellow sparkles. The house was transformed. The cream-colored stucco that hid its homely walls, deep, arched porches that took the place of the old shallow affairs, scarlet Spanish tiles where bleached shingles had been, all united in giving it the gayest, most modern air imaginable. A gravel drive curved in beneath the new porte-cochere, inviting the wheels of my car to explore. Grass had been put in order, flower beds laid out. The new dam was up, and the miniature lake no longer suggested a swamp. If the place had appealed to me in its dreary neglect, now it held out its arms to me and laughed an invitation. As I stepped from my car, I heard running feet, and a girl sped around the veranda to meet me. She cast herself into my arms before I fairly realized this was Phillida. A Phillida as new to my eyes as the house. After the first greetings, I held her off to analyze the change. She was tanned and actually rosy. The corners of her once sad little mouth turned up instead of down, and developed, I looked twice, yes, developed a dimple. The dull hair I always had seen brushed plainly back now was parted on one side, and fluffed itself across her forehead and about her cheeks with an astonishing effectiveness. She was attired in a china-blue linen frock with a scarlet sash knotted in front quite daringly for Phillida. "Why, Phil, how pretty we are!" I admired. She looked up at me like a praised little girl and smoothed the sash. I noticed she wore above her wedding ring that diamond which once had adorned Vere's finger so distastefully to me. It shone bravely in the sunlight with quite a display of fire. Tracing my gaze, she held out her hand for me to see. "Yes, it was his, Cousin Roger. Of course we have not very much money yet, and I do not care about all the engagement rings that ever were thought of. But I was afraid people up here might notice that I had none, and think slightingly of Ethan. So I asked him, and we went to a jeweler who made it smaller to fit me. It is not a false stone, you know. It is a white topaz, and I love it better than the biggest diamond."
"Then you are still happy?"
"Forever and ever, world without end," she answered solemnly. We went in. Sun and sweet wind had worked white magic in the long-closed house. Quaint furniture, no longer dust-grimed but lustrous with cleanliness and polish, had quite a different air. Fresh upholstery in cheerful tints, fresh paper on the walls, good rugs, order and daintiness everywhere changed the interior out of my recognition. Already the atmosphere of home and cheer was established.
"Come see your rooms," Phillida invited, enraptured by my admiration. "They are so pretty."
She ran up the stairs, around the passage, and ushered me into the room of graceful adventure and grotesque nightmare.
I stopped on the threshold. I had ordered the partition removed between the two chambers on this side, giving me one large room. This, with the little bathroom attached, occupied the entire large frontage of the house. This long, spacious room, floors covered by my Chinese rugs, walls echoing the rugs' smoke-blue, my piano in a bright corner, my special easy-chairs and writing-table in their due places, welcomed me with such familiar comfort that I could not identify the neglected chamber where I had slept one night in the old bed with the four pineapple-topped posts. The windows were opened, and white curtains with their over-draperies of blue silk were swinging in and out on a fresh breeze where the horror of my dream had seemed to press itself against the black panes. Decidedly, I must have had a bad attack of indigestion that night. "See how nice?" Phillida was urging appreciation at my side. "We swung those lovely old hangings from the arch, so they can be drawn across the bedroom end of your room, if you like. Although I do not know why you should like, everything is so pretty. Your long Venetian mirror came safely, and all your darling lamps. And I hope you like it so well, Cousin Roger, that you will stay here always." When she left me alone, I walked to the different windows, contemplating the stretches of lawn dotted with budding apple trees, and the lake that lay beyond, shining in the sun. Was Phillida's charming wish to become a fact, I wondered? Could this rest and calm hold me content here, where I had meant merely to pause and pass on? I looked at the yellow country road meandering past the lake into unseen distance. Should I ever see my Lady of the Beautiful Tresses come that way, or travel that road to where she lived? If I did meet her, would she forgive me the loss of her braid? There would be a test for the sweetness of her disposition. When a chiming dinner gong summoned me downstairs, I found Vere awaiting me beside Phillida. We shook hands, and he made some brief, pleasant speech about their having expected me sooner. If pale, timid Phil had become a surprising butterfly, Vere had taken the reverse progress toward the sober grub. I like him better in outing clothes, although he showed even more the unusual good looks which so unreasonably prejudiced me against him. If he felt any strain in our meeting, his slow, tranquil trick of speech and manner covered it. I hope I did as well. It was then I discovered that his wife's pet name for him fitted like a glove. She called him Drawls. The luncheon was good, cooked and served by a middle-aged Swedish woman named Christina. Afterward, I was conducted into the kitchen by the lady of the house to view the new fittings and improvements. Most odd and pretty it was to see Phillida in that role of housewife, and to watch her pride in Vere and deference to him. Let me record that I never saw the daughter of Aunt Caroline fail in this settled course toward her husband. Whether it was born of revulsion from her mother's hectoring domestic methods, or of consciousness that outsiders might rate Vere below his wife in station and education, so her respect for him must forbid their slight, I do not know. But I never saw her oppose him or speak rudely to him before other people. I suppose they may have had the usual conjugal differings, neither of them being angelic. If so, no outsider ever glimpsed the fact. We spoke of nothing serious on that first day. They both showed me the various improvements finished or progressing, indoors or out. We dined as agreeably as we had lunched. Quite early, afterward, I excused myself, and left together the two who were still on their honeymoon. At the door of my room, I pushed a wall switch that lighted simultaneously three lamps.
In this I had repeated the arrangement used by me for years in my city apartment. I have a demand for light somewhere in my makeup, and no reason for not indulging it. There flashed out of the dusk a large lamp upon my writing-table, a tall floor lamp beside the piano, and a reading lamp on a stand beside my bed at the far end of the room. All three were shaded in a smoke-blue and rose-color effect that long since had caught my fancy for night-work, the shades inset with imitation semi-precious stones, rough-cut things of sapphire, tourmaline pink, and baroque pearl. I lay emphasis upon this to make clear how normal, serene, and even familiar in effect was the room into which I came. Yet, as I closed the door behind me, and stood in that softly brilliant radiance, a shudder shook me from head to foot with the violence of an electric shock. A sense of suffocation caught at my throat like an unseen hand. Both sensations were gone in the time of a drawn breath, leaving only astonishment in their wake. Presently I went on with the purpose that had brought me upstairs, lifting a portfolio to the table and beginning to unpack the work which I had been doing in New York. As I laid out the first sheets of music, there drifted to my ears that vague sound from the lake I had heard on my first night visit here, while I stood on the tumble-down porch. The sound that was like the smack of glutinous lips, or some creature drawing itself out of thick, viscid slime. As before, I wondered what movement of the shallow waters could produce that result. Not the tide, now, for the new dam was up, and the lake cut off from Long Island Sound. The pouring of the waterfall flowed on as a reminder of that fact. The sound was not repeated. The dusk outside the windows offered nothing unusual to be seen. I finished my unpacking and sat down at my writing-table. I am not accustomed to heed time. There never has been anyone to care what hours I kept, and I work best at night. Midnight was long past when I thought of rest. I declare that I thought of nothing more, not even recalling the vague unease felt on entering the room. A day spent in the fresh air, followed by an evening of hard work and journeyings between the piano and table, had left me utterly weary. When I lay down, it was to sleep at once. End of chapter 5. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 6 of The Thing from the Lake. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Thing from the Lake by Eleanor M. Ingram. Chapter 6. I have made a story that hath not been heard, a great feat of arms that hath not been seen. Amenemhaet. I woke slowly. It seemed that I struggled to wakefulness as a spent swimmer struggles toward shore. Up through deep poles of sleep I dragged myself, driven by some dimly sensed necessity. Peril had stolen upon me in my unconsciousness, a stalking beast. I knew that with nightmare certainty. It was as if my soul stood affrighted beside my brain, wailing upon its ally to arouse and stand with it against the menace. And my brain answered, but with infinite difficulty, like a drugged warrior who hears the clang of battle and forces numbed limbs to stir, arise and grasp the sword. I was awake. Suddenly the swimmer reaching the surface. How shall I describe fear incarnate? The horror was at the open window opposite the foot of my bed, staring in upon me with slavering covetousness of the prey. It watched. I lay there, and felt it seek for me across the darkness with tentacles of evil that groped for some part of me upon which it might lay hold. The room was still. Between the draperies, the windows showed nothing to the eye except a dark square faintly tinged with the night luminance of the sky. There was nothing to see, nothing to hear. But gradually I became aware of a hideous odor of mold and mildew, of must and damp decay that loaded the air with disgust. I lay there and opposed the approach of the thing with all the will of resistance in me. The sweat poured from my whole body, so that I lay as in water, and the drenched linen of my sleeping suit clung coldly to me. It could not pass the defense of my will. I felt the malevolent fury of its striving. Like the antenna of some monstrous insect brushing about my body, I felt its evil desires wavering about my mental self, examining, searching where it might seize. It had not yet found the weakness it sought. If it did, the sickening, vault-like air I must breathe fought for it. So did the darkness. All this time, or the time that seemed so long, I had no more command of my body than a cataleptic patient. Every ounce of force in me had rushed to support the two warriors of the battle, the brain and will that opposed the clutching menace. But now, as I grew more and more fully awake, out of very loathing and danger I drew determination. Slowly, painfully, I began to free my right arm and hand from this paralysis. As I advanced in resolution, the thing seemed to recoil. Inch by inch, I moved my hand across the bed toward my reading lamp on the stand beside me. In proportion as I moved, the dreadful tentacles drew back and away. A last effort, and the chain was in my fingers. I jerked spasmodically. Rosy light from the lamp flashed over the room. All the quiet comfort of the place sprang into view as if to reassure me. The piano open as I had left it, the table strewn with my evening's work, each bit of furniture, each drapery or trinket, undisturbed. The thing was gone. In the hush I heard my panting breath and the tick of my watch on the stand. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. As I mechanically read the hour, a cock somewhere shrilled its second call before dawn. The horror had been true to the legendary time of apparitions. Weak and chilled, I presently made an attempt to rise. But at the movement, a wave of sickness swept through me. The room seemed to rock and swing. I had just time to recognize the grip of faintness before I fell back on the pillow. Vivifying sweetness was in my nostrils, which expanded avidly for this new air. Perfume that was a tonic, a subtle elixir, that sparkled upon the senses, sank suavely and healingly through me, so that I seemed to draw refreshment with each breath. Reluctantly, I aroused more and more in response to this unusual stimulant, which somehow gave delicious rest, yet drew me from it into life. I could have sworn someone had touched me. With some exclamation on my lips, I started up, to find myself in darkness. The lamps I had left lighted burned no longer. This time there was no terror in my awakening. No thing of nightmare pressed against my window space. The fragrance persisted. The ghastly smell of mold and corruption was gone. But I wanted light for all that. Reaching for the lamp beside me on its stand, I found the little chain. I felt the chain draw in my fingers, and heard the click that should have meant light, but no answering brightness sprang up. Instead, across the dark, came a voice,
a voice low-pitched, soft without weakness, keen with exultation.
"Victory! Victory! You have no need of light, who conquered in darkness. The enemy has fled. It has covered the unspeakable eyes from the eyes of a man. By the will of a man, its will has been forbidden. It has dragged itself back to the barrier, and cowers there for this time. Oh, soldier on the dreadful frontier, be proud. Putting off your armor tonight, be proud and rest."
Those practical people who are never unnerved by the intangible may gauge, if they can, the weirdness of this address following my first experience, and then smile their contempt of me. For I confess to a moment of uncanny chill. The voice was that of the woman who had trailed her braid of hair into my grasp the night I first slept here. But how did she know of the thing's visit to me? I had not spoken nor uttered a cry throughout its visitation. How could she have knowledge of that silent struggle between it and me, or of my escape so narrowly won? How, unless she too— I groped for a glass of water left on my stand. I drank and felt my dry throat relax.
"Who are you?" I asked.
A sigh trembled toward me.
"I am one who stands on the threshold of your beautiful world, as a traveler stands outside a lighted palace, gazing where she may not enter, and feeling the winter about her."
"Do not suppose me quite a superstitious fool," I said brusquely. "You are a woman. The woman who left a very real braid of hair in my hands, not long ago, to save herself from capture."
"Yes, yet I am neither more nor less real than the one which came for you a while since."
"Then my nightmare was real? A thing of flesh and blood, or clever mechanism? You know it. Perhaps you produced it." The rush of my angry suspicion dashed in useless heat against her cool melancholy.
"Real? What is real?" she challenged me. "Turn to the sciences that you should understand better than I, and ask. Stretch out your arm. For a million years, men have vowed you to touch empty air. They saw and felt it empty. But now a child knows air swarms with life. In that thin nothingness, crowd and move the distributors of death, disease, health, vigor, existence itself. The water you have just tasted is pure and clear in the glass. Pure? Each drop is an ocean of inhabitants clean and unclean. I speak commonplaces. But is there no knowledge not yet commonplace? Oh, man, with all the unfathomed universe about us, dare you pronounce what is real?"
"What is natural?" I began. She interrupted me.
"Doubtless, what is not natural cannot and does not exist. Have you, then, measured nature? He was a great thinker, one of deep knowledge, who compared man to a child wandering on the shore of a vast ocean and picking up a pebble here and there."
"Of what would you convince me? And why?"
"Of what? Danger. Why? Would you watch a man enter a jungle where some hideous beast crouched in ambush? Why, you neither warned nor armed him? I am here to turn you back. I am the native of that country who runs to cry warning to a stranger, to put into his hand the weapon of understanding."
So solemn, so urgent a sincerity was in her voice, that again chill touched me. The clammy dampness of my garments hung on my limbs as a reminder of the thing
real or unreal, that twice had made its presence felt beyond denial. Wild as her words might be, their incredible suggestion was matched by my experience. I sought with my eyes for her before answering. The room was dark, yet the darker bulk of furniture loomed out enough to be distinguishable. No figure was visible, even traced by the direction of her voice. I was certain that any movement to seek her would mean her flight.
"Do you mean that you want me to go away from this place?" I questioned.
The sigh came again, just audibly.
"Yes. Why should you die?"
Was I wrong in fancying the sigh regretful? Did I not hear a wistful reluctance in her tone? Excitement ran along my veins like burning oil on flowing water. The woman hidden in the dark, the association of her voice with the strange, exquisite fragrance I breathed, the thought of beauty in her born of that lovely braid of hair I had seized, all blended in a spell of human magic. I have said I was a man much alone, and a lame man who craved adventure. "Just now," I said, "you spoke of some victory. You called me soldier."
"Is it not victory to have driven back the Dark One? Is he not a soldier who, aroused in the night to meet dreadful assault, sets his face to the enemy and battles front to front? Before the eyes men and women have died or lost reason, or fled across half the world, broken by fear. What are the wars of man with man, compared with a man's battle against the unknown? I honor you. I salute you. But, soldier alone on the forbidden frontier, go! Join your fellows in the world allotted to you. Live, nor seek to tread where mankind is not sent."
How can there be wrong in facing a situation that I did not cause?
"There is no wrong. There is danger."
"What danger?" I persisted.
"Can you ask me?" she retorted with a hint of impatience. "You who have felt its grope toward your inner spirit?"
I shuddered, remembering the brush of those antennae, exploring, examining. But I persisted, beyond my everyday nature. Her speech was for me like that liquor distilled from honey that inflamed the Norsemen to war fury. "You say I came off victor," I reminded her.
"Yes, but can you conquer again, and again, and again? Will you not feel strength fail, health break, madness creep close? Will you not be worn down by the thing that knows no weariness and fall its prey at last?"
"It will come often?"
"Until one conquers, it will come."
I forced away a qualm of panic.
"How can you know?" I demanded.
"Ask me not. I do know."
"But look here," I argued, "if, as you say, this creature was not meant to meet mankind, how can it come after me this way?" She seemed to pause, finally answering with reluctance,
"Because, 2 centuries ago, one of the race of man here broke through the awful barrier that rears a wall between humankind and those dark forms of life to which it belongs. For know that a human will to evil can force a breach in that barrier, which those on the other side never could pass without such aid."
I neither understood nor believed. At least, I told myself that I did not believe her wild, legendary explanation of the nightmare thing that visited me. I did not want to believe. Neither did I wish to offend her by saying so.
"You will go,"
she presently mistook my silence for surrender.
You are wise as well as brave. Good go with you. Good walk beside you in that happy world where you live.
Wait! I cried sharply. Her voice had seemed to recede from me, a retreating whisper at the last word.
No, I will not go. I will know more of you. You are no phantom. Who are you? Where? When can I see you in daylight?
Never.
Why not?
I came to hold a light before the dreadful path. The warning is given.
But you will come again?
Never.
What? The thing will come, and not you?
What have I to do with it? Who am more helpless before it than you? Go, and give thanks that you may.
Listen, I commanded, as firmly as I could. I am not going away from this house without better reason. All this is too sudden and too new to me. If you have more knowledge than I, you have no right to desert me half convinced of what I should do.
I can stay no longer.
Why can you not come again?
You plan to trap me, she reproached.
No, word of honor. You shall come and go as you please. I will not make a movement toward you.
Not try to see me even? She hesitated.
Not even that, if you forbid.
There was a long pause.
Perhaps,
drifted to me, a faint distant word on the wind that had begun to stir the tree branches and flutter through my room. She was gone. There sounded a click whose meaning did not at once strike me, intent as I was upon the girl. Twice I spoke to her, receiving no reply, before judging that I might rise without breaking my promise. Then I recognized the click of a moment before as that of the electric switch beside my door. No doubt she had turned off my lights at her entrance and now restored them. I pulled the chain of my reading lamp, and this time light flashed over the room. I had known no one would be there, and no one was. Yet I was disappointed. As I drew on my dressing gown, I heard a clock downstairs strike four. Not a breath or a step stirred in the house. The damp freshness of coming dawn crept in my windows, bringing scents of tansy and bittersweet from the fields to strive against the unknown fragrance in my room. The melancholy depression of the hour weighed upon me. Beneath the gentle strife of sweet odors, my nostrils seemed to detect a lurking foulness of mold and decay. I sat down at my desk to wait beside the lamp for the coming of sunrise. End of chapter 6. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 7 of The Thing from the Lake. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Thing from the Lake by Eleanor M. Ingram. Chapter 7. For it is well known that Paris and such delicate beings live upon sweet odors as food. But all evil spirits abominate perfumes. Oriental Mythology. The breakfast bell, or rather Phillida's Chinese chimes, merrily summoned me to the dining room, a homely spell to exorcise the phantoms of the night. My little cousin, rosy beyond belief, trim in white midi blouse and blue skirt, was already in her place behind the coffee pot. Vere sat opposite her at the round table. They were holding hands across the rolls and bacon and eggs, their glances interlocked in a shining content that made my solitariness rather drab and dull to my own contemplation. At my clumsy step, the picture dissolved, of course. Vere rose, while Phillida welcomed me to my chair, and went into a young housewife's pretty solicitude about my fruit and hot eggs. The sun glinted across the table. The very servant had a smiling air of enjoying the occasion. I never had a more pleasant breakfast. A big brindle cat purred on the window-sill beside Phillida. No dainty Persian or Angora, but a battered veteran whose nicked ears and scarred tail proved him a battling cat of ring experience. "I plan to have a wee white kitten," Phil explained, while putting a saucer of milk before the feline toff. "One that would wear a ribbon, you know. You remember, Cousin Roger, how Mother always forbade pets because she believed animals carry germs? I meant to have a puss if ever I had a home of my own. This one just walked into the kitchen on the first day we came here. Ethan said it was a lucky sign when a cat came to a new home. He gave it the meat out of his sandwiches that we had brought for lunch, and it stayed. So I decided to keep it instead of a kitten. It really is more cat." What footing was here for dreary terrors? In a mirror across the room, I glimpsed my own countenance looking quite as usual. No overnight white hairs appeared, no upstanding look such as the legend gave to Sir Sintram after he met the little master. After the meal, Vere asked me to walk over to the lake with him. We strolled through the old orchard toward the dam. This was my side of the house. In passing, I looked up at the window against which the thing had seemed to press itself with sickening lust for me. Phillida was framed in the open square, and shook a dustcloth at us by way of greeting and evidence of her busyness. The wide, shallow lake lay almost without movement, except at the head of the dam. There the water poured over with foam and tumult, an amber-brown cataract some 20-odd feet across, to rush on below in a winding stream that grew calmer as it flowed. "We must put our lake in order, Vere," I observed, as we stood on a knoll at the head of the dam. "All this growth of rank vegetation ought to be pulled up, the banks graded and turfed, perhaps, the bottom cleaned up. Water lilies would look better than cattails." To my surprise, he did not assent. Instead, he set his foot on a boulder and rested his arm upon his knee, looking into the clear water. "Mr. Locke, I just about hate saying what I have to," he told me in his sober, leisurely fashion. "I expect you won't like it, not at all. Well, best said before you get deeper in. I can't see my way to make farming this place pay." I was bitterly disappointed. Even at the worst estimate of Vere, I had imagined he would stick the thing out a little longer than this. Poor Phillida's time of happiness should have lasted more than these few weeks. But the call of New York, of the lounge lizard's case and unhealthy excitement, had won already, it seemed. I said nothing at all. The blow was too sore. "There are too few acres of arable land, and they're used up," Vere was continuing. "I've seen plenty of impoverished, run-out farms in New England. You could pour money into the soil out of a gold pitcher these 5 years to come, before it began to pay you back. And then your money might better have been put anywhere in bank, for profit. I saw that the first week here. Since then I've been looking around for something better to do." "And have found it, of course," I said bitingly.
or else you would be drawing your salary as manager and saying nothing to me of all this. Well, where does poor Phil go, and when?" He turned his dark-curled head and regarded me with calm surprise. "I didn't exactly know that my wife was going anywhere, Mr. Locke." "What? You do not mean to leave the farm?" "Not unless you're tired of our bargain. I've been calculating how to make it pay. That won't be by planting corn and potatoes and taking a wagon load into town. If you think I'm wrong, call in any practical man who knows this sort of business. We've got to think closer to win here. That's why I'd like to set the lake to work instead of just prettying it up."
"The lake, Vere? There isn't enough water power over the dam to do any more than run a toy, is there?"
He motioned me nearer to where he stood gazing down.
"Notice what kind of water this is, Mr. Locke? Brown, like forest water. Sort of green-lighted because the bottom is like turf. Neither mud nor sand, but a kind of underwater moss. You see? It's pure and clean, with a little fishy smell about it. Matter of fact, it is forest water. Comes from way off yonder, the stream does, before it spreads out into our lake here. I borrowed a boat and followed back 2 miles before it got too shallow for me. Boys have caught trout here 3 times since I've been watching."
"Well?"
"My father was fish warden in our district. I learned the business. If you're willing, I can start some trout raising that ought to pay well. You know, the state is glad to help game preserving, free."
He proceeded to give me a brief lecture on the subject, in his quiet, unpretentious manner, producing notes and diagrams from his pockets. He had written to various authorities and exhibited their replies. He knew exactly what the state would do, what he himself must do, and what investment of money would be required. I listened to him in admiration and astonishment. From fish-raising, he went on to discuss each acre of the farm, its best use in view of its situation, condition, and our needs. We could afford so much labor, it appeared, and no more. We must have certain apparatus, methodically listed with prices. If we used a certain sheltered south field for a peach orchard, the trees planted should be such an age and have giant powder blast deep beds for them in order that they might soon bear fruit. When at last he ended his deceptive speech that sounded so lazy while implying so much energy, and turned his black eyes from the papers on his knee to my face, I had been routed long since.
"Vere," I said abruptly, "did you know that I thought you were going to desert the farm when you began to speak?"
He nodded.
"Yes, I guess so. You don't exactly like me, haven't had any occasion to. You don't judge me a fit match for your cousin. Well, neither would anyone else, yet."
He began to gather his papers together, his attention divided with them while he finished his answer.
"There will be plenty of time before that yet runs out. Mighty pleasant time, thanks to you, Mr. Locke. Phillida and I expect to enjoy building things up as much as we'll enjoy it after they're all built. Meantime, I prize what you're doing all the more because I know how you feel. Now, if you'd be interested to look over these plans, or submit them to someone you've confidence in, for inspection, I'll just turn them over to you."
He had so accurately measured me that I was disconcerted. It was quite true that he was compelling my respect, while my first dislike of him still obstinately lurked in the background of my mind. I felt ungenerous, but I would not lie to him.
"I am a queer fellow, Vere," I said. "Leave that to time, as you say. As for the plans, they are far beyond my scope. A city man, it has been my way to phone for an expert when anything was to be done, or to buy what I fancied and pay the bills. In this case, you are the expert. The plans seem brilliant to me. Certainly they are moderate in cost. Keep them, and carry them out as soon as that may be done. You are master here, not I." We walked back together through the sun and freshness of the early spring morning. As we neared the house, Phillida's voice hailed us. She was at my window again, leaning out with her hair wind-ruffled about her face.
"Cousin Roger," she summoned me, "I have found out what makes your room as sweet as a garden of spices. See what it is to be a composer completely surrounded by royalties, able to buy the most gorgeous scents to lay on one's pillow, and all enclosed in antique gold."
She held up some small object that shone in the sunlight.
"Throw it down," I begged, startled into excitement.
She complied, laughing. Vere sprang forward, but I made a quicker step and caught the thing. It was one of those filigree balls of gold wrought into openwork, about the size of a walnut, that fine ladies used to wear swung from a chain or ribbon and call a pomander. The toy held a chosen perfume or essence, supposed to be reviving in case my lady felt a swoon or me grim about to overwhelm her, as ladies did in past centuries, and do no longer. Whose gentle pity had brought this pomander to my pillow, to help me from that faintness which had followed my struggle with the thing? Whose was the exquisite, individual fragrance contained in the ball I held? I had a vision of a figure, surely light and soft of movement, haloed with such matchless hair as the braid I had captured, stealing step by timid step across my room, within my reach while I lay inert. Perhaps her face had bent near mine in her doubt of my life or death. Hidden eyes had studied me in the scanty starlight. Oh, for Ethan Vere's good looks and athlete's grace to lure my lady from her masquerade!
"Where did you buy it, Cousin Roger? Fess up!" Phillida's merry voice coaxed me.
"It was given to me," I slowly answered. "I cannot offer it to you, Phil. But I will buy any other pretty thing you fancy, instead, next time I go to town."
She made a gesture of disclaim.
"I did not mean that. Only, do tell me what the perfume is."
"I was going to ask if you knew."
"No. Something very expensive and imported, I suppose. Perhaps whoever gave it to you had it made for herself alone, as some wealthy women do. It is the most clinging yet delicately refreshing scent I ever met."
"Tuberose," suggested Vere.
"Drawls, no. How can you? Like an old-fashioned funeral," she cried.
"Tuberose didn't always go to funerals," he corrected her teasingly, as she made a face at him. "I remember them growing in my Aunt Bathsheba's garden. Creamy-looking posies, kind of kin to a gardenia, seems to me. Thick-petaled, like white plush, and holding their sweet smell everlastingly. But Mr. Locke's perfumery isn't just that, either. There was something else grew in that garden. I can't call to mind what I mean. Basil, maybe?"
"The basil plant that feeds on dead men's brains," quoted Phil with a mock shiver. "You are happy in your ideals, Drawls."
He laughed.
"Well, that garden smelled pretty fine when the dew was just warming up in the sun mornings, and so does this little gilt ball. I'll guess Mr. Locke's lady never got it from France. Smells like old New England."
There was no reason why a vague chill should creep over me, or the sunshine seemed to darken as if a thin veil drifted between me and the surrounding brightness. Let me say again that no place could have been more unlike the traditional haunted house. There hung about it no sense of morbidity or depression. Yet what was I to think? I was not sick or mad, and the thing had come to me twice. I turned from the married lovers and made my way to the veranda, where I might be alone to consider the pomander whose perfume was like a diaphanous presence walking beside me. Seated there, in one of the deep willow chairs Phillida had cushioned, in peacock chintz and marked especially mine by laying my favorite magazines on its arm, I studied my new trophy of the night. There was a satisfaction in its material solidity. It was real enough, resting in my palm. Yes, but it was not ordinary among its quaint kind. As I picked out the design of the goldwork, that fact was borne in upon my mind. Here was no pattern of scroll or blossom or cupids and hearts. The small sphere was belted with the signs of the zodiac, beautiful in minute perfection. All the rest of the globe was covered with lace-fine work, repeating one group of characters over and over. I was not learned enough to tell what the characters were, but the whole plainly belonged to those strange, outcast academies of astrology, alchemy, magic, in short. It contained what appeared to be a pinkish ball, originally a scented paste rolled round and dried, I judged by peering through the interstices of the gold. Had the old-world trinket been left to bewilder me? Why, and by whom? What interest had my Lady of the Dark in elaborately deceiving me? Why muffle her identity in mystery? Why the indefinable quaintness of language, the choice of words that made her speech so different from even the college-bred Phillida's? She urged me to leave the house. If she, or anyone associated with her, wanted the place left vacant for some reason, why did not the thing and the warning come to others of our household group? Vere, Phillida, the Swedish woman, Christina, all had lived here for weeks without any experiences like mine. I had not been told to leave my room, but the house. The danger, then, was only for me? Well, was I to run away, hands over my eyes, at the first alarm? The gray cat came purring about me and presently leaped upon my knee. On impulse, I offered the pomander to its nostrils. The unwinking yellow eyes shut, the beast's powerful claws closed and unclosed with convulsive pleasure. It breathed with that thirsty eagerness for the scent so familiar to my own senses. "Better than catnip, Bagheera?" I questioned. "You wouldn't bolt from it either, would you?" Phillida's battered pet relaxed luxuriously, by way of answer, sniffed toward the hand I withdrew, and composed itself to sleep. I put the pomander in my waistcoat pocket. I could not deny as mere nightmare the thing which had visited me. Better confront that fact. It was real. Only real in what sense? What human agency could produce an effect so frightful, an illusion so hideous, that I could scarcely bear to recall it here in full daylight, without the use of a sight or sound to confuse the brain? Had the girl told the truth in her wild explanation? A truth hinted at by alchemists, Pythagoreans, Rosicrucians, pale students of sorcery and magnificent charlatans, these many centuries? Were there other races between earth and heaven, strange tribes of the middle spaces whose destinies were fixed and complete as our own, but between whose lives and ours were fixed barriers not to be crossed? Had I met one of these beings, inimical to man as a cobra, intelligent as man, hunting its victim by methods unknown to us? Was I a cheated fool or a prisoner on the borders of a new country? Could I meet that thing tonight and tomorrow night? Could I bear the agony of its presence, the stench of death and corruption that was its atmosphere? At the mere memory, my forehead grew wet. The postman's buggy had stopped at our mailbox. Phillida ran down to meet the event of the morning. Her laughing chatter came back to me while she waited, fists thrust in middy pockets, for the man to sort our letters from his bags. It did not appear so hard to make a woman happy, I mused. A man might attempt it with hope, if he could but persuade her to try him. My lady had promised to come again. Perhaps with patience. Phillida came across the lawn with an armful of gaudy-covered catalogues and a handful of letters. "Catalogues for Ethan, letters for you," she called in advance of her arrival. "What an important person you are, Cousin Roger. It always gives me a quivery thrill to realize who you are as well as how nice you are. Now, isn't that a jumbled speech to tumble out of me?" I took her tanned little hand along with the letters, letters that were so many voices summoning me back to pleasant, busy Manhattan. "It is a fine speech for a humble person to answer, Phil. But does that sort of thing matter to you women? What do you love Vere for, at bottom? Because he is strong and supple and has curly hair? No?" as she shook her head. "Because he has worn the uniform, then? Proved his courage in war, at sea? Because he had the glamour about him of real adventure and cabaret glitter? Or because he took you away from a life you hated? Or perhaps because he is kind and loves you? No. For none of these reasons? Why, then, love Ethan Vere?" She stopped vigorously, shaking her head in repeated denial, and smiled at me triumphantly. "Because he is Ethan Vere," she promptly responded. "Oh, Cousin Roger, you clever people are so stupid. It would not make any difference at all if Drawls were ugly, or never had been a sailor, or could not skate or do things, or had not been able to make me happy. It is something very much bigger than all that." "And all the divorce courts, Phil? The breach of promise suits, and the couples who make each other miserable?" "But they never had anything," she said. "Perhaps they will have it some day. Don't you know, Cousin Roger, that the most important things in the world are those most people never know about?" I was not sure whether I knew that or not. After last night, I was not sure of many things. Still, if such gifts were given as she believed, if it was merely a question of being Ethan Vere, or Roger Locke. But I had never seriously considered leaving the adventure. End of Chapter 7. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 8 of The Thing from the Lake. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Thing from the Lake by Eleanor M. Ingram. Chapter 8. The heart is a small thing, but desireth great matters. It is not sufficient for a kite's dinner, yet the whole world is not sufficient for it. Hugo de Anima. That evening, Vere and I settled the business details of the developments he had planned. Also, while we three were quietly together, I launched a discussion that had been gathering in my mind all day while I watched Phillida. "You are doing as efficient work as Vere," I told her. "In fact, you are a most moderate pair. I gave you an open bank account, Phil, and you have furnished the house for so little that I am amazed. And it is all so gay, so freshly pretty. Being an ignorant man, the details are beyond me. But one servant? Aren't you working yourself too hard? I had expected you to need several. Of course, we are not counting Vere's outdoor force." She turned in her low chair beside the lamp and glanced toward the window behind her before replying. I noticed the action because a moment before Vere had turned precisely the same way. "It is good of you to think of those things, Cousin Roger," she declared. "But I want to be a real wife to Drawls. I do, indeed. And I have it all to learn, because I was not brought up for that. Look at this dish towel I am hemming. Christina would laugh at the stitches if she dared, yet they are better than when I began. Some day I shall sew fine things." "So it is with all my housekeeping. I think we should begin as we mean to go on, so I have furnished the house for us. Perhaps if it had been for you alone, I should have chosen satin wood and tapestry instead of willow and cretonne. The same way about Christina. If Ethan and I are to save and earn this lovely place, as you offered, we cannot afford more than one maid. You understand what I am trying to explain, don't you?" "Yes," I assented, "surely. What were you looking for just now, behind you?" "I? Oh, nothing. I just fancied someone had passed by the window and stared in. I can't imagine what made me fancy that, unless the cat..." She hesitated. "Bagheera is asleep under Mr. Locke's chair," Vere observed casually. "Truly, Cousin Roger, I love the way we're living," she resumed. "It is very miserable of me, I dare say, not to be more intellectual after all father and mother labored with me. But it is so. I want to live this way all my life, to be busy and plan things with Ethan, and make them come true together." Under cover of the table she put her hand into Vere's, and silence held us a little while. I watched Bagheera, the cat, who sat beside my chair, staring with unblinking yellow eyes toward the window across the room. Did I imagine a slight uneasiness in those eyes, a wary readiness in gathered limbs and muscles, bulking under the old cat's scant fur? Now the tail twitched with a lashing movement. Presently Bagheera looked away and relaxed. A moment more and he curled down, composing himself to sleep. "You like the place, Phil?" I questioned. "You do not find it lonely here, or in any way depressing?" The candor of her surprise told me that no dweller between the worlds had visited her. "Cousin Roger, this darling house? Why?" I passed that question safely, and after a few minutes bade them good night. They had a fashion of gazing at one another that made it a matter of necessary kindness to leave them alone together. As I made my solitary way upstairs, I will not deny a growing excitement, or that dread fought with my resolution. Who would keep tryst with me tonight? The horror or the lady? Both, as each time before? If so, which one would come first, and what might be my measure of success or failure? If some trick were being played upon me, I meant to pluck it out of the mystery. The quietly pleasant room received me without a hint of the unusual. I lighted the lamps and sat down to my work. The house was still by 10 o'clock, all lights out except mine. At midnight I lay down in the dark, the pomander under my pillow. Whether I put the gold ball there from sentiment, or from some absurd fancy about its perfume and mystic carving being somehow a talisman against evil, or because I feared the trinket might be taken from me during the night, I should be troubled to answer. I did place it there, and lay lapped in its sweet odor while the moments dragged past. Heavy, slow-footed movements of strain and dreadful expectation, scarcely relieved by a hope uneasy as fear. The cock crowed for the first hour, and for the second. I slept at last. When I awoke, level sun rays were striking across the world. Nothing had happened. End of chapter 8. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 9 of The Thing from the Lake. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Thing from the Lake by Eleanor M. Ingram. Chapter 9. These Macedonians are a rude and clownish people that call a spade a spade. Plutarch. Next morning I took my car and began a systematic investigation of the neighborhood. There proved to be few houses within reasonable distance where such a woman as my lady could be lodged. However, I made my cautious inquiries even where the quest seemed useless, resolved to leave no chance untried. No better plan occurred to me than exhibition of the pomander, with a vague story of wishing to return it to a young lady with red-gold hair. But nowhere did a native show recognition of the top or the description. On my way home, I overtook a familiar, travel-stained buggy that inspired me with a fresh disrespect for my own abilities. Why had I not put my question to our rural mail-deliverer in the beginning? Surely here was a man who knew everyone and went everywhere. The old white horse rolled placid eyes toward the car that drew up beside it, then returned to cropping the young grass by the roadside. The postman looked up from the leather sack open before him and nodded to me.
"Morning, Mr. Locke," he greeted. "Now let me get the right stuff into this here box, and I'll sort your family stuff right out for you. There's a sample package of food sworn to make hens lay or kill 'em, for Cliff Brown here, that's gone to the bottom of the bag. I don't know, but Cliff's poultry'd thank me to leave it be. Up it's got to come, though."
"Will it make them lay?" I asked, watching the ruddy old face peering into the sack.
"I guess it might, if Cliff told 'em they'd have to lay or eat it, judging from the smell that sample's put in my bag."
"Not as sweet as this," I suggested, and leaned across to lay the pomander in his gnarled hand. The familiar expression of acute, almost greedy pleasure flowed into his face. His nostrils expanded with eager intake of the perfume that seemed an elixir of delight. He said nothing, absorbed in sensation. "Do you know of a lady who wears that scent?" I asked. "A lady with bright, fair hair, colored like copper bronze?"
"Not I," he denied briefly.
"No one at all like that, with hair warmer in shade than ordinary gold color, and a lot of it?"
"No, not around here, nor anywhere I've been. What do you call this perfumery, Mr. Locke?"
"I have no idea," I answered, sharply disappointed. "No one knows except the young lady I'm trying to find. Are you sure you cannot help me at all? There is no newcomer in the neighborhood? No visitor at any house who might be the one I am looking for?" He shook his head, giving back the pomander with marked reluctance. "No one who might be able to tell more than yourself?" I persisted. A gleam of humor lit his eyes. He dropped a cardboard cylinder into Mr. Clifford Brown's mailbox and began to sort out my letters. "Far as that goes, I guess Miss Hill don't miss much of what goes on around here. When she hears a good bit of tattle, she has her husband hitch up, and she goes driving all day. Ain't a house she knows that don't get to hear the whole yarn. You know Miss Royal Hill? Miss Vere gets butter and cheese from her. Might ask her." I thanked him and drove on. Mrs. Hill, garrulous wife of the farmer who owned the place next to ours, was on her porch when I came to a halt before the house. She granted me more interest than the other natives upon whom I had called that morning, inviting me into her parlor to set when she had identified me. But she knew nothing of the object of my quest. "I guessed you must be the new owner up the Mitchell place," she observed, her beady, faded brown eyes busy with my appearance, picking up details in avid, darting little glances suggestive of a bird pecking crumbs. "Cliff Brown said a lame feller had bought it. I don't see as that little limp cripples you much, the way you can rumpus round in that fast automobile of yours. Now, I'm perfectly sound, and I wouldn't be paid to drive the thing. You'd ought to get the other fella to run it for you, the handsome one. I guess you like to do it, though? Writer, ain't you? Books or newspapers?" I rallied my scattered faculties to answer the machine-gun attack. "Music," she echoed, her narrow, sun-dried face wrinkling into new lines of inquisitiveness. "They said you had a piano in your bedroom, but I thought they were just fooling me. Seems I never heard of having a piano upstairs. Most folks like to show 'em off in the parlor. Must be kind of funny, taking your company upstairs to play for 'em. But then it's kind of a funny thing for a man to take to, anyhow. I got a niece, 10 years old, next August, who can play piano so good there don't seem anything left to learn her. So, but there ain't no use of you driving round here looking for a fair-headed girl, Mr. Locke. The Slav folk down in the shanties by the post road are about the only light-complected ones in this neighborhood. Somehow, we run mostly to plain brown. Senator Allen has 2 girls, but they're only home from a boarding school for vacation. How do you like your place?" "Very much," I assured her. "Only, I do not know a great deal about it yet. It's history, I mean. Are there any interesting stories about the house? You know, we city people like a nice legend or ghost story to tell our friends when they come to visit us." She chuckled, swinging in her plush-covered rocking chair, arms folded on her meager breast. "Guess you'll have to make one up. I never heard of none. The Mitchell family always owned it, and they were so stiff, respectable, and upright, everyone was scared of 'em. Most of the men were clergymen in their time. The last, Reverend Cotton Mather Mitchell, went abroad to foreign parts for missionary work with the heathen, 20-odd years ago, and died there. He never married, so the family's run out. The Mitchells were awful hard on women, called 'em vessels of wrath and beguilers of Adam. Preached it right out of the pulpit. So I guess no girl in these parts could have been hired to wed with him if he'd wanted. His mother died when he was born, so he had had no softening influence. After news came of his death, the house was shut up till you bought it.
"My, how you've changed it already! I'd admire to go through it."
When I had invited her to call on Phillida and inspect our domicile, and paid due thanks for information received, she followed me out to the car.
"All this land round here is old and full of Indian relics," she remarked. "Over to the Sound, where the swamps used to be, there was lots of fightin' with savages. And they say a witch was stoned to death where the Catholic convent stands now, on the road up above your place. So I guess you can figure out a story to tell your company, if you like."
"A convent?" I repeated, my attention caught by a new possibility. "Do they, perhaps, have visitors there? Ladies in retreat for a time, as convents often do abroad?" Mrs. Hill laughed, shaking her tightly combed head.
"No hope of your girl there," she chuckled. "They're the strictest sisterhood in America, folks say. Poor Clares, I think they're called. No one, not even their relations, ever see their faces after they join. They're not allowed to talk to each other, even. Just stay in their cells and pray, even in the middle of the night, and shave their heads and live on a few vegetables and dry bread." I laughed with her. Certainly no convent would harbor my lady of marvelous tresses and magical perfume, of wild fancies and heretical theories. That thought of mine was indeed far afield. But where, then, was I next to seek? I made a detour and used some strategy to gain a view of the senator's daughters. They proved to be brunettes who wore their locks cropped after the fashion of certain Greenwich villagers. My disappointment was not great. My lady was not suggestive of a boarding school miss. But I had hoped to find somewhere a trace of the copper-bronze head whose royalty of hair I had shorn as the traitors shore King Childeric's Gothic locks. I drove home with a sense of blankness upon me. Suppose she never came again? Suppose the episode was ended? Not even freedom from the Thing could compensate for the baffled adventure. Think of the lame feller with an adventure. End of chapter 9. Recording by Roger Moline.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.